In the year 2000, in the Northern Territory, Jamie Warramurra, an Aboriginal man, 21-year-old Aboriginal man, walked into an open mine site. He was hungry, he helped himself to some biscuits and some cordial, and he walked out. Unfortunately for him, this was when he was found by the police. This was the third time that he had been brought before a court on a property offence. Under the Northern Territory's then mandatory sentencing laws, the magistrate had no alternative but to sentence Jamie Warramurra to jail for the period of 1 year for stealing $3, supposedly stealing $3 worth of biscuits and cordial. Just 3 years before this, Australia's biggest and most notorious corporate criminal, Alan Bond, was found guilty, pleaded guilty, in fact, of a fraud involving $1.2 billion. He got 4 years jail. Now, you don't need to be Albert Einstein to work out the maths on this. If $3 is worth a year, then $1.2 billion should be worth about 400 million years. Perhaps with good behaviour, we might let him out in 300 million or something, you know, skip a couple of geological eras. But, it's good to laugh, because if you don't laugh, you bloody cry sometimes. But, you know, the point is a serious one. Race and class, and what I'd argue in the talk tonight, especially class, is the determining factor in how our justice system works. It's not just, you know, an added extra, it is the determining factor. So I'll get to all of that, talk about the role of the police and, you know, various proposals to reform it and so on. But I did want to start off, basically, by talking about the report that Beck Smith co-authored. It's really excellent. You can get a copy for free on the internet, or you can have a look at mine. I guess I can pass it around. And it details, it's not about the Northern Territory, it's not about Aboriginal people, it's about the extraordinary level of police harassment and police violence directed at young people of African descent, basically Somalis, Ethiopians, Sudanese, within a few kilometres from here in Flemington, just up the road here in the high rise, also down in Dandenong in Melbourne's southeast and Greenbank in Melbourne's west. And to start off with, I'll read a few excerpts from the report that explain. Well, this first one is one of the young people. They interviewed about 30 young people, a number of youth workers and so on for the project. This is one of the young people talking about how the problem with the police starts. And he says, culturally, we tend to hang around in big numbers, and not only culturally, because for me it really makes sense that I can hang around with my friends if I live on top of them. I can't invite them to my house, he's living in the Flemington high-rise, very small houses, can't invite them to my house, but if I come downstairs, we can really see each other. We saw the flats as our own backyards, honestly, because we don't have backyards, so coming downstairs, coming together, it was all fun, it was all good, until police started coming around and saying, what are you guys up to? What are you doing? We were like, we're not really doing anything other than standing around. Some of the police didn't like the idea of talking back to them, so suddenly the police told us we were hostile. And, you know, in time after time, and the incidents described in the book, there is literally nothing happening before the police arrive, apart from a group of young black people hanging out in social space. This is a story of the escalation of one of these incidents. This is told by a youth worker. Involves a group of 10 to 15 young people. After having eaten, the group was hanging outside their local shops. Two police officers in a patrol car arrived and got out of the car with pepper spray canisters in hand, telling the group to move on. The young men initially refused, but after one of the police officers repeated the request several times, one of the young men decided to cross the road and was followed by the rest of the group. Out of frustration at what they felt was unfair harassment, one of the young men in the group picked up a rock and threw it at a police officer, just missing his leg. A chase ensued. Most of the young men got away, but one was grabbed by both of the police officers. After protesting his innocence, the police agreed and left him alone. The young person in question describes the same patrol car arriving at the same location later that night. Again, a group of young men were hanging around, and again, a young person threw a rock, this time narrowly missing one of the officers' heads. This time, police chased and caught approximately 17 young men. The police called for backup, and 10 police cars carrying 15 to 20 police officers arrived. The young people were forced into a line and then onto their knees, with their hands behind their heads. Police then proceeded to hit individuals' legs, kicking some to the floor and punching some in the back of the head. All were threatened with further violence if they moved from their kneeling position. At the end of this ordeal, the police left without arresting anyone. Young people in these areas report being stopped by the police for no particular reason multiple times a day. The police officer had made comments such as, "You guys, you're an African gang, and we know what you're up to, and we're going to search you all." For people who, and, you know, like, there is a lot in the report, you know, like, I, you know, don't need to go through all the horror stories, but there is a lot in the report of these sorts of incidents. One of the young people described what happened when he tried to, he was bashed by the police and tried to make a complaint about it. Just slapping me in the head, calling me black cunt. This is really common, the level of racist abuse addressed to these young men. And one of the police spat on me. Then they picked me up, and one of the copper goes to me, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" He just started pushing me around, and the other guys were holding me back. And then anyways, they beat me up for about 10 minutes. They kept me in there, and then they let me out in the end. They let me out of the back door. So I went to the front door. I was pretty brave. I went to the front door and I said, "I want to make a complaint." And the one that was at the reception goes to me, "What happened?" I'm like, "I was just at the back and the coppers were beating me up for no reason." He goes to me, "Wait." He went inside, he called one of the coppers that were beating me up. Another copper came in and goes to me, "If you don't get out of here now, I'll pull you back in." And I left. And again, there's a lot of these sorts of stories of people who, you know, try to go through the proper channels, walk through the front door of the police station to report a serious assault, only to get threatened with another serious assault. There's also a pattern documented in the report by the legal workers who put it together of cover charges being laid. As soon as young people might complain about a particular incident, all of a sudden charges magically appear to do with that incident. Thank you. And so there's, you know, basically a range of repressive measures that the police can use to make sure that complaints are never made. I'll just read one more excerpt from the report, for now anyway, which gives the title to the report, which is, "Boys, Do You Want to Give Me Some Action?" Young person described bumping into a police officer at the local McDonald's, where the following exchange occurred. I asked him, the police officer, "Hey, what are you doing?" He goes, "Oh, nothing. I'm feeling bored. Boys, do you want to give me some action? You know, commit a crime?" I'm like, "Are you okay? Are you joking?" He goes, "Nah." He goes, "You run. I'll chase you. We'll do the usual." And he was joking around. I understood that. But like for a second there, I thought, oh, this guy's dead serious. You know, he wants something to go down today. They just do it for the thrill of it. They don't do it because they're doing their job. You know, it has nothing to do with their job. For them, it's just, we're bored, let's go bash a couple of kids. Mm. And summing it all up, one of the young people reported, cops do try to intimidate you and try to get you pissed off, try to make you do something, you know, so that they could charge you, but they'll bash you. Like, they'll bash the crap out of you, and if you throw a punch back, you know you're gone. There's assault police officer. Okay. And again, like, I mean, there's a lot of detail of this sort of stuff. If you really want the horror stories, you know, it's there on the internet. Just Google the title. Out of the 30 young people that the researchers interviewed for the project, the vast majority had experienced personal physical violence at the hands of the police. For the minority that hadn't, someone in their immediate family or a close friend had experienced such violence. So we're obviously dealing with a really widespread and very entrenched problem. And once you start to put that together, I mean, because I guess, you know, there's a racist bashing, you know, once in a while, you can say, well, it's just one or two racist police officers, it's no big deal. Once it's happening seemingly across Melbourne, year in, year out, to this particular, you know, group of young people, you get a slightly different picture. Then you add that to the way that they treated the Indian students when they protested a couple of years ago about the spate of racist bashings directed at them, which was basically being patronising, tell them that there was no such thing as racist bashings in Melbourne, and then when they protested, eventually breaking up their protest by administering another brutal bashing to an Indian student, this time from Victoria Police. Yeah. And it seems like every month or every couple of months there's a major scandal that erupts, even just here in Victoria, to do with the police and racism, whether it's the disgusting emails that were circulated, making fun of different coloured people dying, whether it's an officer using an offensive word for Aboriginal people over the radio, but, you know, being heard, you know, doing so. And the list goes on and on and on. And, of course, it's not just Victoria and it's not just Australia. You can look at the the sickening incidents of Aboriginal deaths in custody, which are continuing actually at a higher rate, around Australia. And as soon as you leave Australia, you can talk about the well-documented cases overseas. It's 30 years this month actually since the great insurrection in Brixton in London, where blacks, plenty of whites as well actually, took on the police about their racist and abusive policing in the famous Brixton riots. Okay. So far from just, a couple of bad apples, then you can go to YouTube and see how many million hits, every song about, racist police, seems to score. Like, obviously, we are dealing with a worldwide phenomenon. So, thank you. So, I guess I want to turn now to look at why we're looking at that. What is it about the police that makes them, that pushes them to act in this way? And to start with, I think we have to take a step back from talking about police as particularly racist and just look at their overall role in society. If you go to the Victoria Police website, you'll find that the Victoria Police contributes to a high quality of life for individuals in the community by ensuring a safe and secure society, which then underpins the economic, social and cultural well-being of Victoria, which is great, except one of the first questions you can ask is why they're so bloody bad at actually doing it. Take one of the, one of the main crimes, one of the most common crimes that affects ordinary people, which is robbery, getting your house burgled or your car knocked off or whatever. You don't have to go very far. You find insurance companies saying, and I found one saying, according to the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics, only 5% of breaking into crimes are solved by the police. This is massive overstatement. There's a lot of crimes that never get reported to the police, because why would you bother unless you have insurance and you need to make a claim or whatever, then you need a number. And there's an awful lot of people that will admit to crimes when in a police interrogation room under the threat of a bashing or under a threat of more serious crimes. You help us fix up these one or two burglaries and we'll, do you some sort of minor favour some other sort of way. So basically, the police rate at solving these crimes is close to zero. They just can't do it. I don't know why they even bother to turn up to crime scenes. They can't actually do it. I'm not exaggerating. Corporate crime, corporate crime again. It's something that they usually don't even bother to turn up to the scene of those sorts of crimes, do they? One recent high-profile example is the Visi Amcor cardboard box scam, which, there's various estimates about how many hundreds of millions of dollars came out of yours and my pockets into the pockets of Visi and Amcor. But there's one common estimate that Visi, one of the biggest cardboard box manufacturers in Australia, owned by the Pratt family, made something like $700 million out of this cosy little and illegal cartel. When, after many years, eventually there was a falling out among thieves, Amcor went to the authorities and, there was court case and fines levied, there was a grand total of $36 million in fines levied by the ACCC. So you can see, actually crime does pay, as long as you do it on a big enough scale. There's, should I trick you to this quote? No, I won't. Okay. So, yeah, it's... Okay. Oh, my popular demand, okay. This is a great book, Crime, Class and Corruption by Audrey Farrell. It's very old British examples, but she talks about this, this class nature of what's counted as crime, what gets clamped down on and what doesn't. She has this great quote from a City of London chief inspector, quoted in the London Times in 1975. He says, "The police must be highly discreet and tread much more carefully than usual where crime in the business community is concerned. There are shareholders and policyholders to consider, and police investigations could cause shares to fall and policyholders to panic. You can't go poking your nose into the affairs of the respectable and important companies without being extremely careful," in their own words. And, it's this sort of attitude that underpins, they don't have to talk about policyholders and shareholders being concerned when they, decide to bash the crap out of a bunch of people in Flemington, but obviously when you're treading around the corporate boardrooms in Collins Street, it's a different story. Even in terms of, the so-called blue-collar crime or burglary or whatever, the police are just incapable of addressing the cause of it. It was a former Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police, actually Neil Comrie, who estimated a few years ago that some 70% of all crimes, so a much higher proportion of burglaries, were committed to feed a heroin addiction. Now, it's not rocket science to say if we actually had, decriminalized heroin, supplied, addicts with the drug that they need, everyone would be a lot better off. The two biggest losers would be organised crime. Drugs are a $7 billion industry in Australia. And the cops, who would lose one of their main rationales for one of the main propaganda points for their existence, which is the rest of us being robbed. Okay. I spent too much time on burglary. It's a very similar story when it comes to interpersonal violence. Basically the cops are only going to turn up after the event. There's no special detective work involved. I won't go through all the arguments, but they are useless for preventing any sort of interpersonal violence, which they say that they're about as well. So, their true role. This is what I would regard as one of the core functions of the police. This is the police in action in Tasmania just last week. Stealing a continent, of course, isn't any crime at all, but if you're an Aboriginal person protesting against thousands of years of human habitation, being basically having a road built over it, this is what's happening in Tasmania, where the police arrested 21 people just last week. Now, we'll move this. Police putting down a riot in Redfern after the police chase led to a death of a young man. This is the police in action at Visy, cracking down on corporate criminals who have ripped, hundreds of millions of dollars out of everyone's pocket, but busting a union picket line last year when Visy, one of Australia's biggest and richest companies, was trying to bust the union. Another shot of them doing their core work. This is the police in action at S11, where the scum of the earth basically came here to Melbourne for a few glorious days, and about 30,000 of us prevented them from getting into... Well, yeah, they didn't look so powerful after we stopped them getting into Crown Casino. It was a lovely time, but the police really don't want you feeling that powerful. So, them trying to ride horses through a crowd is really the least of what they did. This is the police hauling people away after bashing the Indian student senseless in the streets of Melbourne just a couple of years ago. You get the idea. That's APEC. They're actually doing a kettle deer, would you believe? But they're looking pretty mild about it. And the thing about cops is they look pretty much the same all around the world. This is the cops in action busting the miners, or doing their best to bust the miners' strike in 84-85 in Britain. And this is them in action in Egypt just a few short weeks ago. You can see one or two looking around nervously at the size of the crowd. But yeah. Okay. Anyway, I don't know why I really included that, because you all know what cops look like. It's not like but now, the point I wanted to make, though, is that this sort of activity is not just some added extra. It's not just something that's tacked on to, we've got the police, what do we do with them? Oh, no, we'll use them to bust a picket. This is what the police were invented for. And you don't have to be a red or a Marxist or even particularly radical to come up with that sort of conclusion. There's a lot of very straight historians of the police that will say, okay, yes, you've got larger coming 1700s into 1800s, you've got a larger concentration of wealth, you've got a larger concentration of people, the properties people want to protect their wealth. But in almost every case where a modern police force has been created, there's been at least one or a series of key incidents which have provoked the ruling class into forming a police force. Previously, of course, many ruling classes, we're talking about Britain, advanced industrial societies such as that, a lot of ruling class policing was done by the army. Two big problems with the army. First of all, a lot of them, have suspect loyalties when it comes to shooting down their brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts on a picket line. Secondly, they shoot people. Like, they are trained to kill. And there's a series, I don't have time to go through the history. Crime, class and corruption is a really good introduction to it, a series of incidents where basically the army was unleashed on working class crowds in Britain, managed to slaughter a whole lot of people. Now, when you're dealing with a rural insurrection, the great Tory theorist Edmund Burke said, agricultural insurrection, kill six people, maximum publicity, problem solved. When you're dealing with a modern working class, it's a much more powerful force, and it's very difficult to actually shoot the working class off the street. You can do it, but, if you just kill a few people, you tend to actually inflame things. That's a pretty bad summary of a whole lot of history, but, we can talk about it in the discussion if you want. Just one chart that I wanted to show you, though. If the police were really formed to fight crime, where are we? you would expect there to be a fairly close correlation between the amount of crime and the number of police added. This is a chart for the Metropolitan Police in Britain. These bars are the number of police added in any given year. So some years heaps more police were recruited, some years not many at all. And this is the level of convictions for crime. If anyone can spot any actual relationship between those two lines, like, please let me know in the description. Like, I looked at it for quite a while and I really can't see it. So let's take this same chart of the number of coppers added to the Metropolitan Police Force and let's put it against the number of workers involved in strikes in those years. And it's a pretty much exact correlation. So, and again, we can go through the history in the discussion, but this covers 25 years in the history of one police force. But believe me, the general point holds for pretty much any police force anywhere in the world. Oh, sorry, this is in Britain. Yeah. Okay. Where am I? 20 minutes. Thank 21. You. 21. All right, there goes that quote. Okay. I did have a bit of a potted history of the Victoria Police, but from their role in smashing the blacks to their role in smashing the rest of us. But, yeah, I'll come back to that if I have time, but, I'd better move on. So, if that's the general role of the police, is to keep the rich, rich, powerful, powerful, and the rest of us in our place, you know, that's what they're there for. The rest is all propaganda, you know, bits and pieces that are added on and whatever. But their core role is repression. Why are they so racist then? Well, I reckon there's maybe three or four different sort of intersecting answers to that. The first is that, the ideology is that the police are there to prevent crime. In fact, the police can't prevent crime. They don't prevent crime. They've got nothing to do with preventing crime, you know, as all of the figures show. But they sort of, you know, there is this ideology that many police believe that that's what they're there for. Therefore, the tendency is to identify what's called a criminal type, you know. Now, actually, there is no such thing as a criminal type, unless you mean someone who lives in a mansion in Toorak, you know. But, you know, there's a whole lot written about how to identify a criminal type. This is, Audrey Farrell, again, has this nice little quote from a police training booklet from 1978 in London. It's called Catching Criminals, Some More Basic Skills. So, all you budding Sherlocks can take your sharpened pencils and take them out. The new constable is informed. The most important quality of a thief catcher is basically a question of being able to categorise or stereotype a person. It goes on, the good criminal catcher learns to differentiate between persons from different countries. Constables are encouraged to look for clues to criminality, such as dress, facial appearance, tattoos, voice, accent, hair, eyes, and odour. You can sniff them out, apparently. Now, the observant among you will notice in that list, it doesn't actually mention skin colour, as if we look at skin colour, you know? But, like, you know, of course, like, any copper reading that is going to say, oh, yeah, it's the blacks at the crims, you know? It's obvious, I read it in the manual. So there is that, you know, and I think that is a real factor. They just look for easily identifiable types. Okay. The other thing is that the police in their role often run up against black people in an antagonistic sort of relationship. You can see this with Aboriginal people, from Smith Street, just a couple of kilometres that way, where the local traders have now pushed the local council to pass a bylaw, which basically is designed to sweep, it's just supposedly about stopping people from being drunk in Smith Street, but if you're drunk in a cafe or a pub in Smith Street, that's fine. If you're black, sitting outside Safeway and taking a sip from a flagon in Smith Street, this is what the police have to, you know, move people on all the time. So they've got to justify some reason in their head why it's okay to do this, because they have to do it day after day. They have to clear the Aboriginal protesters away in Tasmania. They've got to justify some reason in their head why to do it, and, you know, why it's okay for them to do it. And racism, of course, is the easiest way to do that. The other thing, of course, is that racism is not just any old prejudice. It's not just some random set of ideas that some people happen to have. racism is extremely functional for the system. So, a group of coppers decided to form another prejudice and decided that they were going to hang around, you know, Toorak or Camberwell or Brighton and, you know, bust people, you know, see them reversing out of their driveways. Well, that's illegal for a start. You know, what a start for the day. So, you know, let's start harassing these people. Of course, that's ridiculous. These cops would be hauled into line in no time. But when they start bashing, victimising and generally terrorising people with different coloured skin, well, this is something that's actually, it actually works for the system. You know, it reinforces racism. And for that reason, like, there's a bit of tut-tut, but really, they're never hauled into line for it. Audrey Farrell, thank you, puts it this way. Among groups of predominantly white workers, it is often common to find a good deal of racism. But even here, arguments from anti-racists and the experience of, you know, working alongside people fighting against the boss can undermine these ideas. With the police, it is different. Racism is necessary for the job. It arises out of the divisive function that they perform. The police rarely experience collective struggle, which can break down racial prejudice. Indeed, when the police are engaged in group activities, it is often in conflict situations which increase racist attitudes. So I reckon that's the core of it. You know, they're there to uphold the system. The system requires racist ideas. They're therefore allowed to flourish in the police force. There is one other thing to add, though, which is the factor of boredom. You know, because they're there to uphold, you know, they're there to repress us, but that's not a full-time job. They've got all this time on their hands, basically, to tool around, armed to the teeth, dosed up on ruling class ideology, looking for trouble. And if they don't see any trouble, well, they're bored out of their minds, so they create trouble. And again, this is not just me saying it. There's been a lot of respectable studies into police chases, you know, which often end in fatalities, that show a major factor is police being bored. Audrey Farrell quotes this, you know, three-volume study done in London in the 1980s about what police do with their time. Finds that, you know, like, a bunch of them spend up to 3 hours a day in the canteen. A bunch of them spend a whole lot of time in pubs talking with known criminals. That's called gathering intelligence. Like, you know, they're looking for ways to fill their time and picking on a marginalised group that they don't think can fight back and that they know that there's no repercussions for picking on. Well, this is a fine idea, according to them. Okay. Right. All right, yeah, I'll skip a bit there, and talk about, because I've talked for nearly 30 minutes, and talk about, well, responses to this. One of the really good things about that report that I handed around earlier from, that was published by Springvale Legal Service, is they talk about this thing called community policing, and any time problems with the cops come up, there's a politician or a copper or some well-meaning academic that will say, well, community policing, you know, increased bonds of trust between the community on the one hand, the police on the other hand, all these misunderstandings will disappear and we'll all get along famously. And they spend a good portion, like almost half, in fact, of the report talking about community policing, because it's been tried extensively in Melbourne, as a solution to these problems of harassment and violence directed at young people of African origin. And what they find is that the young people who engage in this activity basically want to do it because they want less policing. They want the police to stop harassing them every hour of the day. The actual consequence of this community policing, though, is more harassment. Basically, you know, the cops see this partly as PR. You know, it's not to do with bonds of trust and all the rest of the crap. It's because we have to look good in front of the media. So I've got one example in there, actually, of the police refusing to work with a group of, you know, very disengaged young African people and instead choosing to do a whole lot of activities with a group of young African people who are actually doing really well at school and had, you know, good connections with the local community. Then they get them, the cops get themselves into the media talking about how great they are for doing all this work with disengaged youth. And actually that had, like, it had a really demoralising and debilitating effect on some of those young people. It actually started, according to the report, started for at least one young person, started a process of disengagement and disillusionment, which led to one young person dropping out of school altogether. So, you know, part of it is PR. Part of it is wanting more contacts in the community, so basically to use as police spies. And there's a lot of evidence in that report of young people being accosted on the street by cops who are involved in community policing alongside them and saying, oh, well, now that we're friends, you know, you can tell us, oh, who's this person? Where does this person live? You know, I've got a photo here. You know, he's one of your mates, isn't he? What's his name? You know, and the young people really don't want a bar of it. They feel that more and more of this community policing is about, you know, it's increasing policing rather than reducing it. Okay. There's even an instance where there was cops and young people involved in a community policing activity during the day. That night, one of those very same young people gets bashed by one of those very same cops. Like, it is, yeah, at best it's a fraud. In fact, it's worse than that. Okay. So if you can rule out community... Oh, and the other thing, the other book I should recommend is Jude McCulloch, Blue Army. Jude is an academic nowadays down at Monash University, but she was very involved in the campaign run by Flemington Legal Service when the police... I forget how long it took them. They killed... It was just after I moved to Melbourne. They'd killed about 11 people in the space of, I think, about 2.5 years. Like, shot them dead. Jude was very involved in the campaign. I can't find the list. Was very involved in the campaign around that. And she talks about community, and this book is all about paramilitary policing in Australia, and in particular in Victoria, where, you know, more and more military-style training, military-style weapons, military-style tactics are used by police. And she talks about community policing around the world has been used as a cover, you know, for this sort of process. On the one hand, a more militarised police force. On the other hand, this community policing facade. Okay, so if we can rule out community policing as any sort of alternative. I do remember many years ago, we actually had Jude McCulloch speak at a forum about the police and police shootings and so on, and the question came up about reforming the police. And she gave what I still think is a really excellent answer, and she said, no, the police will never be reformed. You can't reform the police. You can't change what they're there for, but you can police the police. And that was basically what that campaign run out of Flemington Legal Service did. You know, they organised families to speak out in public, with public meetings, with media statements, often at huge cost to themselves. You know, the number of times that the families of these young men who'd been shot by the cops had their houses raided, had their houses trashed by the police, is just extraordinary what they went through. But by making a public fuss about it, they actually managed it. Like, the end result was... the police still kill people, but not at the same extraordinary rate as what they were doing. They were officially retrained. It was seen as a crisis of the police force and so on. So that's one example of the police being policed, I suppose, of people using the democratic space that we do have, you know, to put pressure on the police and their political masters to rein in the worst excesses. I did want to read about... just one excerpt about one of the more successful, because obviously the question comes up in the report, what the hell do we do about this if community policing is no good? There's a variety of things that they talk about. They talk about one of the strategies that had been successful, as one interviewee related. So we've got the mothers on our side, which was, you know, I can't thank the African mothers for what they've done for us, honestly. The mothers started speaking out. They told the fathers to back off. They know nothing about what's going on. Actually, that's a whole other story. The mother started coming out onto the street. Some of the mums actually sat outside for hours just to watch if the police were going to do something to us. And then we've had times where we were standing, playing basketball, and the police car would come, and they would park the car right in the middle of the basketball court, and everyone would be like, stand around, and we're like, man, we're playing here. And they're like, I don't care, unless you give all your names up, I'm not going to move. So the mums would come and the mums would start screaming at the police, and the police are like, okay, what's going on here? And so diplomatically the police will say, oh, calm down, we'll be leaving now. And so the police would leave and the mums were like, we saw that, they started it, you guys are good boys. Well, that's what we wanted to hear, so we were really happy about it. So again, you know, a case of the community organising, people in the community organising to police the police. And the story I started with as well, like I did a bit of Googling for Jamie Waramara. I wish I knew what he was doing. I actually have no idea. People tell the story without any sort of follow-up. But part of the huge controversy around Australia and around the world that happened after that outrageous sentencing of 1 year for supposedly stealing $3 worth of biscuits and cordial was the overturning of the Northern Territory mandatory sentencing law the following year in 2001. Definitely not saying that everything's all rosy up there, but again, some of the worst, most gross excesses can be reined in through that sort of political action by making a fuss. Okay. The problem, of course, is that we're talking about symptoms. The police are a symptom of class rule. And, you know, while we have rich and powerful people who want to stay rich and powerful, they will have something like the police to keep us all in their place. What would a future be like, you know, if we had an entirely different sort of police force or an entirely different sort of approach of policing? And there's, you know, a few books written about this, and you can have a lot of, there's a lot of column interest spent on it and so on. But we can actually see, if you want to see what the police of the future might look like, it's a little bit like this. And if it looks like they're playing soccer to keep warm in the streets of Cairo, it's because they are. These are actually the neighbourhood committees, or one of the neighbourhood committees. People would know that one of the responses of the Mubarak regime to the revolution developing in late January was to for the authorities to actually open the jails and tell everyone in the jails, okay, now you have to go out and commit some crime. I saw this thing on SBS where, like, there were people still in the jail saying, we don't want to commit crime, you know? Like, we've had enough of that. Like, actually, you know, just go commit crime, come on, you know? So, you know, like, yeah, and in response to that, there was a wave of looting and so on across the capital to try to, you know, derail the revolution. Local communities organised themselves. Some of the richer neighbourhoods, which I won't bother to quote, you know, hired a bunch of people to stand around all night and, you know, protect their property and so on. But some of the... Some of the poorer communities were really interesting. I heard a... I'll just have to wing it. I heard a woman being interviewed on ABC Radio one time by a journalist who said, well, aren't you scared now that there's no police around? And it was one of those short pauses that indicate, you know, I'm talking to an idiot. Actually, no, it was the police that were the main source of my fear. You know, you could be bashed, you could be robbed, you could be raped, you could be abducted. Like, you know, these police could do anything. It was a police state. Now, the people doing the policing and keeping my neighbourhood secure from the thugs are my neighbours. If I've got a problem with them, I just go and talk to them. You know, it's that easy. Not to say, of course, that it will always be that easy. Not to say that, you know, these things will always be straightforward. But I'd much rather deal with local community people playing football to keep warm and keeping an eye on things than the bunch of... And I'll finish with Ned Kelly's words, because they never get quoted enough. One of the saddest victims of the Victoria Police, who he described as a parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splay-footed sons of Irish bailiffs or English landlords, which is better known as Officers of Justice or Victorian Police. Thank you.